The following presentation is brought to you by Priority One.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I guess the first lesson about Emunah is Al Tiftachu B'Nedivim. My apologies, but the little bit that I took the belt, knew not to take it too long, was just unpassable, so I apologize. Your parking in Brooklyn isn't too great either. But that having been said, I think that we're here this evening, whether it's in person or electronically, to discuss something which for too long has really not been a topic of polite conversation in our homes, in our families, in our community. In fact, as recent as maybe 10, 12 years ago, it was almost deemed inappropriate to discuss Emunah, to question whether anybody needs any chizuk in Emunah, to make any efforts or arguments or references to try to deal with the issues, almost as if to pretend that nobody has any questions, everybody is completely clear, nothing to be concerned about whatsoever. Unfortunately, the lessons of the last decade have shown us that nothing could be further. Well, maybe something could be further from the truth, but it's certainly not so simple. And because of that, I think there has, of recent, been much attention, or at least tentative attention, being paid to this issue of Emunah, what we know, what we believe, what our children know, what they believe, what we would like to believe that our children know and believe, and how we have to really try to deal with this issue. Well, I think it could be summarized as follows. It certainly would not be fair to say that those of our children that are not succeeding in their chinuch, in their schooling, in their Yiddishkeit, are not succeeding because of all of the questions that they have about the basics, the basic tenets of Yahadus. I don't think that would be correct to say. However, I think it would be correct to say that for those that are not succeeding, more questions arise. And when the answers are not forthcoming, the questions linger. The doubts get bigger. The confusion gets greater. And it certainly compounds whatever difficulties they are having. And I would also say that it's true that even those of our children that are successful, maintaining the proper lifestyle, committed to their studies and to Shmiras HaMitzvahs, also are probably lacking answers to issues which occasionally bother them, sometimes are even a little bit confused, and would all benefit from a greater chizuk, an awareness, an understanding of the underpinnings of the truths of Yahadus, which would help them no matter who they are today and no matter at what level they are functioning. And therefore, I think that this discussion this evening is really relevant to all of us and to all of our children. I'd like to just touch on some of the basic points and then have some time for discussion. If we had to summarize in our own minds, and let's place a hanocha that the clarity that these issues have in our own thinking is certainly going to make a difference in the lives and the minds and the thoughts and in the feelings of our children. If we had to summarize, what are the two basic principles, the two basic pillars upon which the appreciation for Yahadus rests, upon which our desire to remain committed to Yahadus and to follow Torah u'mitzvahs with all of its responsibilities and despite all of its difficulties, can be summarized in two words. The Torah is true, and it's good. It's true, it's real, it's the Dvar Hashem, it was given to us by the Creator, and it's going to assure a better quality of life. It's going to make me happy. It is good for me. And both of those ingredients are equally critical to for a person to maintain the commitment and the understanding of the basis of Torah Misinai. And the reason for that, I think, is really very simple. And I think it requires just a basic insight into human psychology. If we, or if our children, are not convinced that a life of Torah u'mitzvahs will make us happy, then at some level, whether conscious or more likely below the conscious level, we don't want it to be true. We don't want to hear about it. We don't want to believe in it. We don't want to accept it. Because accepting it and believing it and admitting to its truth will have a negative effect on our quality of life. I'm not going to be happy. I don't believe that this is going to make me happy. I don't believe that this is going to make me feel good about life, about myself. And therefore, I don't want to hear from this. I don't want to know from this. I would rather that it not be so. Now, when one rathers that it not be so, it compounds the difficulty of even the most logical arguments to explain and to show something to be true, because I really don't want to hear it. We hear what we want to hear. We believe what we're motivated to believe. If we have negative motivation, or if we don't even have enough positive motivation, we have trouble believing. We'll constantly be thinking of questions. We don't want to really hear it. And I'll come up with this and this confusion and this doubt and this question and this issue and can spend a life just running around in circles because I don't perceive that it's going to make me happy and therefore I don't want it to be true. On the other hand, if I believe that it's going to make me happy, I believe that it's going to enhance the quality of my life. I know that this is good for me, but I don't know that it's true. We still have a serious problem. And that problem is, wow, a life of Torah mitzvahs makes me happy. After a while, I say, who knows if there isn't something out there that could even make me happier? Because I don't know that it's true. I just know that it's good. So I'll look for better good. I'll look for more good. I'll search and keep searching for more and more and more others and others. So a person will not stop at the good life. The only way for a person to remain committed to the good life of Torah u'mitzvahs is the realization that, number one, it is good for me. It's going to make me happy. And number two, that it is true. Which means that in the lives of our children, if their early experiences in a life of observance of Torah mitzvahs is not rewarding, is not fulfilling, is not a source of happiness, is frustrating, is sometimes even overwhelming or devastating, that they're going to have problems with the Amitias HaTorah, with the truth of Torah Misinai, because for me, it's better that I shouldn't believe in it, that I shouldn't think it's true. And even if you'll show me with evidence, and even if you'll present the testimony which validates this truth, I don't want to hear it. My ears, my eyes are closed, my ears are stuffed, because I don't believe, my early experiences teach me that a life of Torah mitzvahs does not make you happy. It's a burden, it's a pain, it's overwhelming, it's frustrating, it's guilt-ridden. It doesn't make me feel good. And therefore, it's critical that from the earliest stages of life, everything associated with Torah mitzvahs, that means with the joy of the learning itself, that means with the joy and the appreciation for the performance of mitzvahs, all of it must be pleasurable experiences. They all must add to the sense of good feeling that a life of Torah mitzvahs presents to me in order for me even to want to continue to discover, to believe, to recognize, to accept the truth of Torah Misinai. And therefore, if we do find people that have doubts or questions, it's more likely than anything else that they stem from the negative experiences that they have had with this lifestyle in the past. I think once many years ago at one of these seminars, which actually were developed by this group called Arachim in Eretz Yisrael, they really, so many others have learned from and taken from their research and their experiences and their materials over the years. But I think at one of the Arachim seminars, it seems there was I wasn't there, but I was told there was a young man and a young woman. And the young man was listening to all the lectures, and he says, you know, you've convinced me that this is true. I believe it 100%, there's no question about it, beyond any reasonable doubt. He says, the only thing is I couldn't live my life like this. That's not a way to live. There was a young lady there that she said, you know, that I would love this lifestyle. It's beautiful. It's so attractive. But it's I can't believe that it's true. So it doesn't mean just because you believe it's good, it doesn't always mean that you feel it's good. And just because you don't believe, but it's often very much related. Anyway, so the speaker was a wise guy, and he suggested that they two should get married, and they'll be able to complement each other. But the truth of the matter is we need both. It has to be good. It has to be true. If it isn't good, I don't want it to be true, and I'll have trouble hearing it. If it isn't true, the goodness will wane. The goodness will lead me to think about other things eventually and search for good in other places. That having been said, I think it behooves us first, especially as parents, to focus on how can we make a life of Torah and mitzvahs good for our children. How can our children feel a sense of meaning, purpose, and happiness in their observance of Torah mitzvahs, which will set the stage for their intellectual desire and openness and eventually craving to appreciate the truth of Maamar Har Sinai. I think to do so, we first have to visit for a moment the definition of happiness. You know, everybody wants to be happy. Everybody's looking for happiness. Very few people seem to find it. I often think that the reason for it is that nobody knows what it is. If you don't know what you're looking for, you're not going to find it. What is happiness? We find in the Lashon HaKodesh that the Sheirish of the word describes to us the essence of the concept. The Sheirish of a very high form of happiness, Osher, Ashrei Yoshvei Beisecho. High form of happiness, David HaMelech said, Acha Shoalti Beis Hashem, Shivti Beis Hashem. That's what he wanted more than anything else. Osher, Ashrei Yoshvei Beisecho. The Sheiresh seems to be from Ishur, the Asher, to validate. Happiness is about feeling good about myself. If I feel good about myself, I am happy. If we can induce in our children a good feeling about themselves, then they will be happy. And if they realize that their mitzvahs, that their learning, that their participation in our homes permeated with Torah mitzvahs is making them feel good about themselves, then they connect happiness with a life of Torah mitzvahs, and they're ready, open-minded intellectually, to recognize, to hear, and to appreciate the truths of Maamar Har Sinai. To do this, I believe, requires some effort. It requires some sensitivity and wisdom. We must look for opportunities for our children to succeed and appreciate that success in Torah, and to recognize and award that success and reward that success at every juncture possible. They have to have positive learning experiences. They have to have learning experiences which are exciting. after learning experiences which not only are fulfilling in the sense that you get a little candy, which may be good for a little kid, but they have to be satisfying in their challenge, in their intellectual stimulation, in the excitement that they generate. I look forward to the fight, to the battle, to the argument, to the insight, to the creativity that I can find and that my parents can recognize and appreciate. Wow, what an insight. What a profound insight. What a beautiful thought. What a revolutionary idea. What an accomplishment. How good I can feel about myself. They must also feel that a life of Torah and mitzvahs is a life of privilege. It isn't a burden. Like Reb Moshe Feinstein, Zecher Tzadik Levrocha, said once at a hesped of a certain family explaining why they were zeichet to have Doris of Yireim Ushleimim. He said, these children never heard the words, Oy, sishver zu sein Yid. It wasn't a burden, it was a privilege. Shmiras HaMitzvahs was a privilege. Everything that I did was a privilege. I feel flattered. I feel honored to be privileged, not burdened. And that makes me feel good about myself. If I am the recipient of privileges, if I am the recipient of privileges given to me by the Borei Olam himself, wow, I'm choshuv. I feel good about myself. And the more they appreciate what the mitzvahs are doing, the more they appreciate the goal of mitzvahs, as Chazal tell us, lo nitno teiru mitzvahs ela letzarif ben esabriyos, that the whole purpose of teiru mitzvahs is to purify and to refine the character of mankind. And I become a better person through every mitzvah that I do. And I can achieve great lofty levels of human development and of perfection. And that the Torah demands of me, and the ultimate goal is mahu afato, hevedemelo, that I'm told to be enlightened to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that I was created b'tzelem Elohim, that I have this infinite human potential which mirrors the potential, which mirrors the mitzius of the Borei Olam himself. Things like this, thoughts like this, opportunities like this, wow, I feel good. Oh, choshev. That's really what, you know, they say that when the Alter from Slabodka met Reb Yisrael Salanter, and he once asked him, how do you make a yeshiva? So they say Reb Yisrael told him one posuk, lahachyus nefesh sholim ulahachyus lev nitkoyim. You have to lift up the downtrodden, lift up the broken heart, make them feel good about themselves. Everything that we do with Torah and mitzvahs has to make us feel good about ourselves. Now, I must add in an aside, but I think it's very critical, criticism about the shortcomings in their performance of mitzvahs doesn't make them feel good about themselves. The greatest, most dramatic expression of the devastating power of teichocho, and that isn't to say that parents don't have to guide their children, but it's guidance, it's education. Even the sheirish of the word discipline, I don't know if they're ashoroshim, is disciple. They have to learn the lessons, not be forced and not be coerced and not be overwhelmed. But one of the most dramatic, probably the most dramatic example of the dangers of teichocho, or what Rashi brings at the beginning of Parshas Dvorim, where he says, Yaakov Avinu apologizes to Reuven that he wasn't moichiach him before, only on his deathbed, when I guess it's a little easier to deal with. And he says to him, he says, Reuven, I didn't give you tochocha before because I was afraid that had I given you tochocha before, you would leave me lidobek be'esov ochi. You're going to leave me and go join forces with Esav. You'll go join Esav's yeshiva. Yaakov Avinu, who knew how to give teichocha in a nicer way than any of us can, to Reuven the tzaddik, who had already done tshuva for his mistake, he's telling Reuven that he's afraid. Where's he going to go from that teichocha? To Esav? Teichocha can be devastating. So if we wish to make our children feel good about themselves in their Yiddishkeit, the constant nagging and criticism and pressure that we put on them. You didn't do well enough, or you did wrong, you did bad. It's terrible what you did. Even if we listen to that dictum that says, don't criticize the person, just what they did. But what he did is bad enough to reflect on a criticism on the person. We got to be so careful. If we're not careful with that, we could be sending them away, not just with a bit of feeling against Shmiras HaMitzvahs and against their parents, but even against the Amitius of Torah Misinai. Because my sense of my religious experiences, they don't make me happy. No matter what I do, it's not enough. I'm always falling short. My parents are always criticizing me, day and night, no matter what I do. I thought I was doing so great. It's a critical understanding of how we have to deal with them to make the Shmiras HaMitzvahs positive, and how this can, Rachmana Litzlan, impact even on the basics of Emunah that our children will or may not have. Part of what also affects them in the unhappiness with the life of Torah Mitzvahs, which is seeding the confusion about the truth of Torah Misinai, has to do with the fact that they feel that they don't appreciate what they're doing. They don't understand what they're doing. What is it all about? Why am I doing this and why am I doing that? And we might think that that's not so important. Our children have to know that there's a Torah and you have to do the mitzvahs and Hashem said so and that's the way it is. And that's true. In fact, that's the ultimate truth. It's a gzeira. That's what we have to do. But that ultimate truth, if especially in our children, and I'll show you in a moment, even in ourselves, if it isn't understood on some level as having benefit for us, and how that benefit works, it can cholila lead us away and astray completely. The Sefer Achinuch, in a very famous mitzvah, when he speaks about kol sur v'chol dvash lo yisaktiru isha l'Hashem, not bringing leaven or honey on the mizbeach in the Beis HaMikdosh, and he's writing this book to his 13-year-old bar mitzvah bocha, his son, for a gift for him and his friends, and he says, I don't really know a reason for this one. He gives a tam b'toelus on all the mitzvahs. And he says, I don't know the reason. He says he was ready to leave it out. But he says, I'm afraid that if I don't give tam b'toelus on all the mitzvahs, and the Torah seems to my son and his friends as a sefer chosum, it's like a closed book, I'm afraid that the following will happen. Pen yivatu bohem mitoichkach ben arusum v'yanichum le'oilom v'yeilcho lehevel. They'll rebel against all the mitzvahs in their youth and forsake them forever and join the foolishness of the world. This is 500 or more years ago in the house of one of the Gedolei HaRishonim. You think he may have been a Talmud of the Ramban. This is a father who has explained every one of the other mitzvahs with tam v'toelis, reason, benefit, on each one of the mitzvahs. And this is not about a mitzvah that he's going to do every day because he goes to the Beis HaMikdash and he can't bring along his honey. No Beis HaMikdash, it's not Negei LaMaisa. But he's afraid that one mitzvah, which allows a sense that the Torah is a Sefer Chosum, he might go off the derech, pen yivatu bohem mitoichkach ben arusam v'yanichum le'oilam. Forsake the Torah mitzvahs forever. Why? It's an excuse, albeit, but it doesn't make sense. I don't know. Why? They must know why. They have to have some sense of there's a benefit in it for me. It makes them feel good. It makes them enjoy it. It makes them feel privileged because it's a benefit. We don't feel as much of a privilege doing empty actions. I hate to say it because it's really an exaggeration. But if our children feel that the Shmiras HaMitzvahs is like building Pisam in Ramses was in Mitzrayim, where the city was built and then it was destroyed and then they built it again and then they destroyed it again, that frustration of doing hard work without understanding any benefit in it, no tachlis, it's not for us, too overwhelming for them. And therefore they have to see, they have to have some sense. The chinuch was afraid of one mitzvah without that, which was not Negei LaMaisa, they could go off the derech completely. So we certainly have to be careful with our children. When they ask why, we have to give them a sense that there's benefit, there's something in it for them. And if we don't know the benefits, then We have to find out. We have to take the question seriously. We can't ignore our children's questions. Their questions, when we ignore their questions, it's like we're ignoring them. It's like we're disenfranchising them. It's like they're not smart enough to ask a good question. They know we don't care enough about them. They don't know enough about what they're talking about. It's a whole shalshelis of confusion and resentment that begins. And the end result is they don't have that sense of feeling good about Torah mitzvahs. And if you think that only applies to our children, just for the record, I want to share with you a Ralbag. The Ralbag writes in the Toelius at the end of Parshas Lech Lecha that if you wish to convince a loved one to do something which is bizarre and painful, muzar or bizar, first, before you tell him what it is, tell him the benefits. And the cheshik for the benefit will make it easier, will mitigate the bizarreness and the pain. Where do we learn this from, says the Ralbag? From HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaking to Avram Avinu before he tells him about Bris Milah. He says to Avram Avinu, you're going to enter into a covenant with me. Doesn't tell him what the operation is about. And then he says, you're going to have children, descendants, many nations. You're going to inherit Eretz Yisrael. And only after all of the benefit does he tell him. And what I want you to do is this operation for such an old man, which was never done before, so bizarre and painful. And then the cheshek for what's going to happen, my children, Doiris, Eretz Yisrael, that will make it easier even for an Avram Avinu who reached the highest levels of Shleimus in his Avedis Hashem. Even for Avram Avinu, it will make a difference. So it's very important that our kids, their questions are answered. They have a sense. It's good for them. It's benefit. It's not a burden. It has toelis. It has benefits for them. And has a tam. It's geschmack. It's very, very, very important. Also, before they come, and this is all, I mean, I'm purposely doing it this way to present all of these things even before we talk about what we refer to commonly as emuna, because these are really all of the underpinnings that have to be in place in order for our lesson or our discussion or the information about the yesodus of Yahadus to even begin to enter into their minds and their hearts. It's also very important to have a concept of tefillah. Tefillah is something that turns our kids off so much time every day. Not everybody, but many. So much time a day, not understanding what we're saying. Not only not understanding the words, but not understanding what we're doing. Being bothered by such basic questions as, and the finest of our kids ask these questions, why does Hashem need so much praise? What are we doing every day? The same thing over and over and over and over and over again? Doesn't he get tired? We certainly do. Question. What am I asking Hashem for? He knows what's good for me. He knows what I need. If he decided that I should be poor or rich or sick or confused or fail or pass or whatever, that's the best thing. What am I asking him? What am I bothering him? Well, what's going on? Confusion. What does it all mean? What is it supposed to do? Am I bothering him too much? Like, confusion. Many of our children don't understand that the praises that we praise Hashem and everything that we do in tefillah is all for our benefit. They don't understand that there's nothing we could do to benefit Hashem. They don't understand, as I saw a mole from the Vilna Goin, that praising Hashem, Mokel, Agudul, Agibor, Vahanoiro, is like... If the President of the United States would walk in and we would welcome him, this is a big room, I don't even want to say it, but it's small enough. Welcome, President of this room. It's an insult. I'm the President of the United States of America, and you welcome me as the President of this room? Anything we say about HaKadosh Baruch Hu with any level of understanding that we have is an insult. But he allows us, and he even commands us to do it, because we benefit from it. It strengthens our emunah. It strengthens our bitochen. We connect with HaKadosh Baruch Hu more the more we recite, and not just lip service recite, but internalize intellectually and emotionally the recitation of his praises, his greatness, Gibor, Noiro, Kel, Elyon, Gebel, Chasodim, Toivim, V'zeicher Chasdeyovo, Yisum, Evi, Goyel, Melech, Oizer, Moshiach, Umogen, V'chulei, V'chulei, V'chulei. I become a different person. I have a deeper hakor of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I have a deeper connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I can develop a deeper sense of trust in him because of all of his greatness and his mildness and his involvement and his caring. So it's for my benefit. And the praises have to be repeated all the time, not as words. As words, it doesn't do very much. But as concepts, as ideas, deepening every day that we recite those praises and we think about it, we get a closer connection, a deeper understanding of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Every brocha that we make over every hanah that he gives us in this world, if we pay attention to the brocha, I connect more, a deeper appreciation. This drink is a gift from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This food is a gift from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This bodily function is a gift from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Without his kindness, I wouldn't be Pekeach Ivrim. I'm not blind. I make the brocha every day. Because without Hashem's chesed, I would be blind. He makes me see every day. He allows me to walk. He provides me with all of my needs. And every day that I make these brochas, there could be a deeper appreciation. And it isn't as if your 10-year-old is going to start davening for 4 hours a day because you made this speech. But just knowing that there's a benefit to look forward to, just knowing that as I grow, I'll deepen my appreciation for life. And as the Kuzri says that the reason that the Chachomim were misakin the Birchas Hananim was just to enhance our Hanor. Greater pleasure, because when you stop to make the brocha before you just keep eating without even realizing what you're doing, hey, this is a gift. Without it, I wouldn't have it. It's a gift from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Wow, I appreciate it. And these are things that our children have to hear. They have to understand that we ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu for things even though he didn't give it to us. That which we deserve, he'll give us without asking. But we want more sometimes than we deserve. Very few of us would be happy or just give me just what I deserve and nothing more, nothing less. Yaakov Avinu, we find in this parsha, asks that the Sipurnu learns that that's the pshat. V'hoyo Hashem li le'lukim. Says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will protect me through all these things. Then he says that he will serve Hashem and he'll ask Hashem only to treat him with din and not with chesed, not with rachamim. That's not for us. We want rachamim. We're little people. We can't take the suffering in this world. We ask Hashem, please, if someone's sick, we ask for refuah. If there's financial problems, we ask for parnosa. If there's security issues, we ask for Yeshua. These are things that we need, and we have to realize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us a mitzvah. And through the schus of tefillah, when we deepen our connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when we deepen our sense of appreciation of his powers and of his caring and of his love, and as the Goyin tells us, the shirish of the word tefillah, the Goyin writes, you find in Avnei Elio, I think in Shemea Tefillah, in the Siddur HaGro, he says that the shirish is a positive machshova. It's bitochon, it's optimism. He says, Ro'i ponecha lo'i pilolti, what Yaakov said to Yosef. That's what tefillah is. A sense of bitochen. I become optimistic. I trust Hashem's going to help me. Hashem's going to help me. And it's the schus of these feelings and the schus of this elevation that we have coming closer to him. In that schus, all of a sudden, he begins to grant us things that we didn't deserve before we started the process. Whatever it is, this is very much in brief. And we'll have time after, okay? Highlights. But just these ideas, they have to, from early time, 7, 8, 9, 10, our children should begin in discussion when they ask questions. And the best speech is always in answer to a question. Not, you know, that's when you have a captive audience. When they ask the question, they're interested, they're motivated, they want to hear and take advantage of these things. They have to see Hashgacha Protis. The reason that so many of our children, I neglected to mention one of the biggest questions they have is, people ask, and he doesn't answer. So lamely, sometimes we tell them, well, sometimes the answer is no. The Gemara says, tefillah is a machtzo. Tefillah always accomplishes something. The answer is never no. The answer may be not now. The answer may be not yet. The answer may be this is not the best thing for you. The answer may be I'll give you what you really want, not the thing that you're asking for. You're asking for something, but what you're asking for is really asking for trouble. But I will come and redirect your tefillah so that you'll get the thing that you really want to make you happy. It'll take a little time. Now's not the right time. If you get it now, you may lose it sooner. It may not work now. You'll be frustrated. You're not ready for it. But that's because we know HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He's there. He understands. He's involved. He cares. He loves us. He wants to help us more than we want ourselves. These are all part of the hasogas that they have to have. And when they do ask about why he doesn't answer, they have to learn about Hashgacha Pratis. A child who becomes attuned to Hashgacha Pratis, and today there's tens of books that are written about, and the biggest tachlis of all these books is when you read one of them, you start to discover more Hashgacha Pratis in your own life, in your own family life, in your own family history, in your parents, in your grandparents, in your past, in your history, and in your present. And we see this Hashgacha Pratis and we share it with our children. It should be second nature that they see the Yad Hashem in everything. They see every minute, the slightest little Hashgacha should be viewed as the Yad Hashem. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is involved. And that's how he answers our tefillas. He's constantly doing for us. He's constantly giving us what we want. He may not do it exactly the way we ask because he knows better than we do. But he takes care of us. And seeing Hashem's Hashgacha and feeling the Hashgacha Pratis is a tremendous... Anyone, first of all, a kid who's introduced to Hashgacha Pratis will understand, will see, will discover it himself, herself. And at that point, then the yachas with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is forged. That concept of relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is extremely important. They have to see in our lives, and this can only be modeled, it can't be preached and taught. They have to see a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In our grandmothers and our great-grandmothers, we used to see our grandmother sitting there and saying a kapitel tilim over the chont. The kugel tat mistama also. These are the things, they live that way. Halva yispalil odom kol ayoyim, Chazal say. Our great-grandparents used to do that all day long. A tefillah, a brocha, another tefillah, another tefillah. They have to see that. They have to see our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They have to see our bitochen, that just because it's a problem, we don't get overwhelmed and bent out of shape because the Rabbeinu Shalom takes care of us. He's involved with us. Me and him, we're like this. Not that kind of relationship, the one Yena said, you know, the guy that said we have a great relationship, he don't bother me, I don't bother him. Not that kind of a relationship, but an active, loving, caring relationship. Anila doidi v'doidi li. That type of a bond. They have to see that in our lives. We have to feel that. We should work on that in our own lives. We should feel that through our tefillahs. We should feel like this. Somebody said, I never was able to find out who, says, when I pray, I speak to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And when I study Torah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaks to me. That sense of an active, interactive relationship with the Borei Olam, that's what our children have to feel, see, it has to be modeled, and they have to inherit it. And I think there's one more critical point before we discuss the intellectual underpinnings of our emunah, and that is, I once found in a Talmud from from Chaim Volozhiner, Talmud Muvik of the Vilna Goyen. Chaim Volozhiner is a Talmud. He writes that to fulfill the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, Pesach night, telling my Vihigadot Olabincha, if you don't teach your child about Tzadik Varaloi, if you don't teach him some mahalach to understand the suffering in this world, you didn't fulfill your mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. Because you want to be mechazik the amuna. You want to show him HaKadosh Baruch Hu and his involvement in our lives and our interaction and relationship with him. If you don't deal with the issue of suffering, then they will not be able to get that message. That message gets lost. That message gets confused. That message may even be resented. And therefore, it's critical to forge some path of an understanding of the suffering in this world. The truth of the matter is, and just for our purposes for the moment, understanding suffering is really not an intellectual issue. Intellectually, it's really very simple. Simple on many levels. It's simple. What we find, Rashi brought it in the previous week ago in the Sedra, Orecha Arur, V'Orchecha Baruch Orecha Arur, is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu rewards Rishoyim in this world in cheap currency, to give them their due in the next world, in the real currency, in the eternal currency. And Tzaddikim he punishes in the cheap punishments, the easy ones in this world, to be able to spare them those and reward them the good in the next. Intellectually, not so difficult. Intellectually, like we find in Koheles, if there wouldn't be tzaddik v'ralo v'rosh v'tovlo, there wouldn't be any good in this world. Everybody would be programmed. Do good, you get reward. Do bad, you get immediate punishment. Everyone's doing good. No bechira chofshis, no credit, robotic, meaningless. So there has to be suffering in this world that doesn't make sense. Otherwise, there would be no human greatness. There would be no human bechira. Logical. Bechlal, after everything else is said and done, it's not logical to ask a question on HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Madua derech reshoim tzleicho, the Novi asked. That's not a logical question. You ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu to tell you why. You think if he tells you why, you'll understand it. If I do, I'm going to argue with him. No, I don't agree with that reason. Not shaykh. It's not intellectual. It's emotional. It's emotional. Suffering is an emotional question. Oy vey, so much suffering. Such a fine person. Such a tzaddik. Little children. Rabbeinu shalayla vifali d'shir. That's an emotional feeling. It has to be understood as such, number one. And it has to be dealt with as such. And just a couple of just very, very brief highlights. And all of this really has to be expanded. And there, today, Baruch Hashem, there is a lot of literature that parents should view themselves in the role of mechanchim. You know, the truth of the matter is that the mechanchim have just taken over for us as parents. But originally, it was the parents to the children. That was the way the Messiah was given over, and that's still the way. The Chiyuv Chinuch is on the parents, and so we have to, you know, become as adept in this skill as possible, in these skills as possible. Emotionally, it's an issue. Well, if emotionally the Holocaust, let's say, presents an overwhelming, you know, I don't understand it. The Rabbeinu Shalom understands. And there's such a thing as Arvus too, which we find, and Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh B'Zeh, and we could be held responsible for somebody else's chatoim as if I did it, if I had the ability to stop the person and I didn't. I mean, there's so much intellectually, but emotionally it's so overwhelming. You know the best antidote to the emotional suffering of the Holocaust? Hashgocha Protis, the miracles that took place. Stop what's left while we still have them of a Holocaust survivor. And here, the miraculous, everyone could be made into a movie. Everyone's personal story could be made into a movie. And listen, Hashgocha, Hatzola, Nisim Gluyim. Never forget my first experience, it wasn't the first, but driving many years ago in Yerushalayim with a taxi driver, and he talks to me how he's angry, his family and the Holocaust, this, he's angry at Hashem and so forth. So I asked him, I said, how did you get out? He starts telling me a story which I'm sure Spielberg would have paid $5 million for. And I says, you know, such miracles. And he says, I never thought of it that way. Miracles. Nisim Gluyim. And those Nisim Gluyim of Hatzola are the only antidote to the Hashchosa, to the devastating losses, because it's emotional. The losses are emotional. The pain is emotional. The questions are emotional. The disturbance is emotional. And the Chizuk that comes from seeing the Hashkoches Hashem, Nisim Gluyim, what happened to so many thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of individuals who were saved, this sort of balances out the emotional pain. The questions it doesn't answer, the questions are beyond answering, and that's not even for us, but the emotion. But then there's another technique too, which I think is also very important to learn. That's what we find in Sefer Iyov. Iyov was a rich man, healthy man, had 10 children, lost his children, got very, very sick, lost all of his wealth. And he's sitting 7 days, he couldn't even speak. They came to be Menachem, they waited for him to speak, and they couldn't even speak. And then he sits with his friends, and they're trying to understand it, to come to some understanding, what's going on, what happened over here. Such a holy tzaddik, how could it be, hayitochen? At the end, in Perek Lamed Ches, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to him, Vayomer Hashem El Iyov, Eifo Hayisa B'yosti Oretz. Where were you when I created the world? What are you asking questions for? What are you talking about? You want to understand logically? Were you around from the beginning to the end? Where you see like that panorama, you know, where it looks like the needle point upstairs, where you see everything fitting in, and from the side down here, all you see is the messed up threads hanging down? Eifo Hayisa B'yosti Oretz. I have a question. Why did he wait 38 prokim to tell him that? That's the ultimate truth. That's it. You can't understand it, Eiyof. Intellectually, you won't understand it. The Teretz is, he had to agonize. And he had a right to agonize. And to try to understand. Because it's an emotional issue. And the emotional pain will not allow the truth to come forth. And only after such agony and frustration, where I really can't figure it out, it just don't make any sense. Then, and only then, can HaKadosh Baruch Hu tell him the truth. It's beyond you. You can't really understand such a thing. You weren't around from the beginning of time. But not only that. Rashi in the previous Pasuk learns Pshat in the Pasuk that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, before he says, Eifo HaYisa B'yosti Oretz, he's meramis to him. He's going to have 10 children again. He's going to get back his health. He's going to get his wealth. Only then was he able to hear it. It's intellectually very simple. But it's emotionally overwhelming. And without the attempt to understand it and frustration of not understanding it, and the hint and the promise that it's all going to be better later, only then can a person hear it. But we have to have this sense of confidence ourselves. We have to be able to be mechazik, people who are suffering, who are bereaved. Our children have to see that we have a right to be distraught. We have a right to cry. We have a chiyuv to cry. But we also have to have that overriding sense of trust and confidence in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that he knows what he's doing. He knows better than we could possibly second guess him. And that we have that faith and courage and trust, and everything then comes into perspective. Almost like there's a story they say about a Rebbe that they asked him why all these things were happening in the Holocaust. And his answer was very wise. He says, I'll tell you the truth, I'm an old man, and many years ago I learned I don't ask Hashem why. Because I'm afraid if I ask him why, he'll be glad to oblige and say, come on upstairs and I'll be glad to show you the whole picture. And I'm not quite ready to go. So this is the type of feeling and sense that we have to give our children. Okay. This and much more that hasn't been said, having been said, I think that we're ready just for a couple of basic strokes in the misnomered, I guess the word would be, referred to wrong word in Yosef Emuna. The title to this evening was really not accurate. It's not about strengthening Emuna in the home. It's about strengthening Yediyah in the home. And this basic concept has to be understood clearly by us as parents, and then over the years, with questions, with Shabbos table discussions, with late night, the kid can't sleep and all of a sudden has a question, you know, about something or other. We use the opportunities to try to clarify the issues. And what do I mean? The concept of emuna is belief. I remember once I was traveling once in Chicago and I stopped into Daven Mincha many years ago and I found in a shul, I found an old book, must have been published in the 40s, like the forerunner of the Kiruv books. And it said that we have to take the leap of faith. I was a little bit appalled because leap of faith is a Christian concept. In Yahadus, there's no leap of faith. The Torah says, V'yodato hayoim. The Rambam calls it Yediyas Dovor Zeh. It's a idea, it's knowledge. Why? Because our claim, forget about any evidence or testimony, our claim to the basics of our emuna, of our life, of Yahadus, is radically different from the claims of other religions. Yahadus preceded them. We preceded the major religions by far. All the religions that exist today, I think, Kemat, we preceded. And they all copied so many things from us But there's one claim, or two claims, or maybe if you want, three altogether, that we claim that nobody dared to copy. The claims being public miracles. Not somebody saw a miracle and he went and told it to a lot of people and convinced them that it took place. Public upheavals of Chukai Shamayim Ba'oretz, public miracles. Public revelation by the Bnei Olam himself in front of an entire nation, millions of eyewitnesses. Not claimed by any other religion in the world in history, ever. And an offshoot of that, public communication directly to the Navi, to the representative, to the leader, to Moshe Rabbeinu, in front of the millions of witnesses that stood by Har Sinai. As the Pasuk says, Hinei Onoichi Boi Lecha Bavre Onon, Bavur Yishma Ha'om Bedabri Imoch, Vegam Becho Yaminu Le'olam. That he appears to Moshe Rabbeinu in the thickness of this cloud, so that the entire nation should hear when he speaks to Moshe Rabbeinu, Vegam Becho Yaminu Le'olam, and based on that, they'll believe in Moshe Rabbeinu forever, because they know Moshe Rabbeinu is the authorized, appointed, official spokesman of the Bnei Olam. Public miracles. Mitzrayim, Yitzias Mitzrayim, the Makis, the Yamsuf, the Midbar. Public revelation. Few million people by accounts. We're just talking in the world of claims. By the terrorist account, 600,000 men between the ages of 20 and 60. Similar amount of women, children, elderly people. Talking about a few million nefoshes. Hearing themselves, seeing Vayaris HaKoylois Vesalapidim, reaching the level of Nevuah themselves. They all achieved temporary Nevuah at Har Sinai. They heard Onoichi Velo Yelecho Mipi Agvuro. They heard HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaking to Moshe Rabbeinu. And they knew when he said Onoichi Hashem Elokecha Asher Hotzeisicho Me'eretz Mitzrayim, that he identified himself. Hey, I'm the guy that did all those miracles in Mitzrayim and the Yamsuf. That's me. Now I'll tell you why I did it. This is the purpose. Everyone participating in this experience, everyone as an eyewitness, and in an amazing feat of unity, which bespeaks the ultimate of human testimony, recording all of these events in a document which doesn't say these events took place and now I'm giving it over to my children, but which says, we witnessed these events. Atem ra'isem ki min ha'shamayim dibarti imochem. Atem ra'isem ha'shisi b'mitzrayim. Hishamu luchem pen tishkach es ha'dvorim asher ro'u einecho. Yoyim asher o'madet olifnei Hashem alikecho b'choyrev. All of this written in a document, and every parent of that generation, millions of people passed it on to their children, and their children to their children, and it was passed on to this very day, not just in an accurately written document that hasn't been changed over 3,320 years, and wherever we find Sifrei Torah, we find the identical story, but it's been passed down with an oral tradition as well, and with a lifestyle that reflects it. A Shabbos to remember creation and Yitzias Mitzrayim. Tefillin, tzitzis, mezuzah, remembering Yitzias Mitzrayim. Mitzvahs upon mitzvahs, all the mitzvahs, the idios ha-Torah, there's chukim, mishpotim, and there's edios, that are constantly, we live our lives, yomim tovim, constantly reliving the events of Sinai, the events of Mitzrayim, passing it on to our children, testifying it on our doorposts, and on our hearts, and on our minds, and on our garments, and throughout the generations, and everybody's been doing the same thing, the same tefillin, the same tzitzis, the same mezuzahs. Lo yomim ki yisupar. And all of this is such powerful testimony that we have to Maimon Har Sinai. And what's interesting is, this is just a claim, what's interesting is that all the nations, all the religions that have copied so much from us, you know, they all copied the Shabbos, they didn't even go too far away. We got it on Saturday. The Islam took it on Friday. Christianity took it on Sunday. Copy, 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 copycat. That's what religions are, copycats. All from us. And yet these claims, no religion ever copied. The truth is, it seems there are five religions that do say that there was public revelation and public miracles. But they all say it happened to the Jews in Sinai. Judaism, Christianity, Islam, they all say that. They're based on that. Then they say he changed his mind. Mela. Sikhism and the Baha'i faith, they all say, yeah, there was a revelation to the Jews at Sinai. Nobody dared to copy that claim. And you know the reason for it. It's not very profound. What's the reason for it? Like the story, you know, with the two Hasid, with the Rebbe that passed away and he left two sons. And they're fighting about who's taking over. And back and forth, a big battle ensues. And finally, one comes into the Beis Medrash one morning. He claps on the bima. He says, "It's all resolved. Father appeared to me in the dream." He says, "I should be the Rebbe." His brother says to him, "If Father wanted you to be the Rebbe, he should have appeared to me. You could say whoever you want appeared to you. Joseph Smith says the angel Moroni appeared to him in upstate New York. And Muhammad said Allah appeared to him in the middle of the night when the historians say he was having an epileptic fit. But that's besides the point. Anybody could say what they want. But Atem Reisem, you witnessed, you saw, you millions of eyewitnesses saw these things with your own eyes. You can't get away with that claim unless it in fact took place. So we have a claim of eyewitness testimony. And we have testimonial that have been passed down throughout the Duras, the Sefer Torah. It's amazing how it's been kept intact. Nothing has been kept so intact throughout the generations. There's a rabbi in Hollywood, Florida, who told me that he brings regularly a Sefer to fix the Sefer Torah. And the Sefer told him, sorry, Yerushalayim Ayid, I think he is, with Langa Payas. So the Sefer told him that when he comes down there, he goes to the Reform rabbi also, and he checks his Sefer Torah. So the Sefer said he once asked the Reform rabbi, he says, what do you need a guy like me to check your Sefer Torah? Says the rabbi said, this is the only genuine thing I have in this whole temple. I want to make sure it stays that way. Nobody changed it. It's the same to this day. The power of testimony. Besides that, something else that's very unique in Yahadus. And the more that our children hear examples of this, the more it strengthens them. But it shouldn't be presented. In fact, nothing should be. This whole discussion, you know, I get excited about it every single time. And every single time I say this, I apologize. I say, that's not the way. You should present it in a monotone. It's just like very matter of fact. Because when you get too excited about it, you know, people think you're trying to do a number on them. Don't make a big deal. Just like, you know, a funny thing happened to me on the way to the office. Your kid happens to ask a question. You're talking about it. Just start with the uniqueness of the claim. Forget about how blatantly obvious it is that it's true. But just the uniqueness of the claim. This is the way it is, you know, da, 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 very. But there's something else, too, which also has to be implanted over the years. And for this, by the way, there is a series that we're actually, we have published something on it, but it's coming out like weekly emails. If you make sure to sign up, if you have an email address or even a fax, I think it could be done. Something like to talk at the Shabbos table, which could be helpful. And that is, there's evidence in the Torah that it could only have come from the Bir Yoilam. Not only testimony of live witnesses who witnessed these events and recorded them as events that they witnessed, not that they heard about or believed to have happened, and passed that testimony on to their children, to their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren. But anyway, not very technologically savvy. But evidence that exists that no human being could have been the author of this document of our Torah, not Torah Shebichsav and not Torah Shebal Peh, unless it was the Bir Yoilam himself. And that's very, I think, important for our children to hear. Such things as Nevuah. Nevuah. We find it in Parshas Bechukosai, Churban Bayis Rishon, in Parshas Kisavoy, Churban Bayis Sheni, with all of its details. Check the history. There are many books that are written which compare the historical record and the Nevuah and see the Torah reads like a history book. All the events that took place were written down and predicted even before they took place. Nevuah. There's so much information that couldn't possibly be known or be controlled by a human being. One of the most famous, I think it's on the flyer that we had for this particular evening, that's actually in a tshuva from Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, Zecharenu Livrocha, where he writes that, where Rashi says, the Torah says, Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe Bahar Sinai. He gave the parsha Shemitah Bahar Sinai. The Torah says, Shemitah was taught at Har Sinai. So Rashi brings the Shaila. He says, Mayin Shemitah Etzel Har Sinai? Why did he have to tell me Bahar Sinai that Shemitah was given Bahar Sinai? So Chazal say that just like Shemitah was given Bahar Sinai, we should learn out from there that all the mitzvahs are given Bahar Sinai. So Reb Moshe, I saw once from the Chassam Sefer, the same thing, asked the Kasha, Fort, why do you have to tell me by Shemitah? I just told you want to learn out from one mitzvah was all given by Har Sinai? Was given by Har Sinai? So now since I know this mitzvah was given by Har Sinai, I know everything was given by Har Sinai. So why don't you tell me about something else? Why Dafka Shemitah? So he says, Shemitah is clearly indicated that it was given by the Bayri Olam and Har Sinai. Because what is the mitzvah of Shemitah after 6 years of, you know, running the land, of emptying the land of all that it has? The seventh year, it's going to lie fallow. No planting, no harvesting, is a balabas, nothing. And if you're going to say, the Torah continues, what are we going to eat? What are we going to eat? We have the sixth year, the seventh year we can't plant, we can't harvest. How am I going to survive? So the Torah says that, Kodesh Baruch Hu says, V'tzivisi esbir chosi bashona hashishis, v'yosos es ha'oretz l'shloish hashonim. You're going to get a special brocha, a bumper crop every sixth year, and it's going to be enough for the sixth, for the seventh, and until you can reap the crops of the eighth. Who except the Noisin HaTorah B'Maimon Har Sinai could have assured such a thing? Moshe Rabbeinu would have to be out of his mind if he made up this mitzvah, if he made up this Torah, if he made up this religion. How could you guarantee that every sixth year, and that's the worst year when it's been used for so many years and it didn't have a break, the sixth year is going to be the best crop, enough for 3 years? And if it wouldn't happen, it'd be all over. It could only be that Shemitah was given from Har Sinai by the Bayri Olam, and from there we learn to all of the other mitzvahs. The truth of the matter is that there are so many other mitzvahs that are also indicative. There's a mitzvah Aliyah L'Regel, and the Torah says, V'lo yachmod ish es artzecho. You go up to Yerushalayim, all the men, women probably went, but they weren't mechuyev. The elderly stayed home, the little children stayed home, even on the borders. Took 3 or 4 weeks, the whole trip back and forth. That's why they waited to save a Saint Talamota until Zayin Cheshvan. And v'lo yachmon ish es artzecho. Never will anybody be jealous. No one's going to invade your homes. You'll leave the borders empty, vulnerable. Nothing's going to happen. Had anything happened, it would be all over. How could Moshe Rabbeinu make such a statement? The Torah says Moshe Rabbeinu is not the author of this document. This was given to us by the Bayri Olam. It's from the Noisin HaTorah Bahar Sinai. And there's much information, there's so much scientific information that we find in Chazal that last week, when did we learn? V'achar Yoldo Bas. So the Gemara brings over there that, you know, she was mispalel and this, and then it changed from a ben to a bas, and that's what the Gemara says about you could be mispalel till 40 days, you could be mispalel shetele jishti zohar, something that science poo-pooed until 1990. Until 1990, in every high school biology book, it was clearly indicated that the determination of male or female of the embryo happens at the moment of conception, and that's it. And now science knows that although there was a genetic determination at the moment of conception, it actually could possibly change. The actual development of Zohar or Nekeva can change until 40-something. They had an article then in the New York Times when they said, what do you say about the discrepancy? The rabbi said, and the Talmud said 40 days, and scientists now were saying 43, 42 to 46 days. So they asked the rabbi at the interview, and he says, well, science is catching up. You know, so this is what's going on. And when they see Nevuah, the Torah tells us that Klal Yisrael is going to come back to Eretz Yisrael. Who ever heard of such a ridiculous thing? After so many years of exile, to be able to return to a homeland? Even Herzl was ready to settle for Uganda. How do you come back? It's unheard of. And all the simonim. You know why it's called the green line, the Kav HaYarok? Because unless there are Jews living in Eretz Yisrael will lie barren. It won't be able to produce. And Kol Zman the Arabs were there. It wasn't that they were worse farmers. Maybe they were. But it couldn't produce. Nobody could make it produce. Jews started coming back. The shuk is full. All the haftochas of the Torah, kibbutz kolyus and everything. It's unbelievable. To what extent? Just the survival of Klal Yisrael is the greatest of miraculous predictions. And will be small in numbers. You know, small in numbers is a so, the Torah says, will be v'nisharte misei ma'at, it's a sociological impossibility. Because a nation, either it dwindles and disappears, or it grows. To remain around the same numbers throughout our history. And to have such an influence in the world. And the whole world should be talking about us, as the Torah says, will be the Moshe L'Lishnino. Everything was predicted. Everything was told to us. And every time our children see a little bit, and don't make a big deal about it. You know, it's the best nusach I have for this is like, a funny thing happened to me on the way to the office. Just take it for granted. You have a vort. If you happen to get one of these things, you like what it says. You read it, you discuss it at the Shabbos. And, ooh, wow, look at that. Very interesting. That's all. But eventually what it does, coupled with the testimony when they read the parshiyos of Maimon Har Sinai, and they ask questions and they hear, and they recognize that, and then they see all of this evidence, the testimony and the evidence to the Amitius HaTorah. When that is supported upon a foundation of the good life that is Torah Misinai, of the benefits of Torah Misinai, of the happiness that a life of Torah Misinai, the privilege, the feeling good about myself that Torah Misinai engenders, with that combination, I would suggest that most of our problems that we have with questions and sfeikus and even those that have compelling reasons to run off the derech wouldn't be so free to do so had they had this clarity of knowledge. And unfortunately, we find today by a lot of yeshiva kids that they feel they've learned a lot of information, but they don't have these basic concepts clear. Now, as parents, we probably have to do a little more homework before we can really articulate these things clearly. But to become more aware ourselves, you know, if you want, it's time well invested. There's a book from Uri Zohar, My Friends We Were Robbed. I think Feldheim published it. And the book is a heavy book. It's beautiful, but it's heavy. But in chapters 11 and 12, just deal with this, the Amitius of Maimon Har Sinai. Something very, it's difficult. Don't give it to your 8-year-old to read. But it's very powerful. It's probably the best English language presentation of the truth of Torah Misinai. And these things, we have to become more versed in these things. We have to become more versed in the scientific wisdom that we find in Chazal, in the prophetic information that we see, and constantly over a period of many years, share them with our children. Share with them the Hashgacha Pratis. Show them that mitzvahs benefit them and make them feel good about themselves. Take every opportunity that we have to listen to their questions and attempt to answer them. And if we don't know the answers, there's nothing wrong with saying, I don't know. However, it's such a good question, I would like to pursue it further, and we'll ask this one or that one, or we'll find out the answer, but it's taken seriously. I think that these ideas can serve as a basis for a strengthening of, I guess, what we called emunah. I guess, you know, we should maybe just conclude by giving some perspective to that word emunah. We're talking about yediyah. It's knowledge. By the way, before anybody really is comfortable with any knowledge, there has to be a standard for the establishment of truth. And the standard for the establishment of truth should never be, and this is a mistake that sometimes we tend to make, should never be beyond the shadow of a doubt. I've heard people say this, and it's a terrible mistake. Because anyone to whom you wish to convince of whom you wish to convince something of something beyond the shadow of a doubt will always see shadows. They'll always be nervous. Maybe, maybe, maybe. Nothing is beyond the shadow of a doubt. We drink the water beyond any reasonable doubt that it's not going to kill us. We go into a car beyond any reasonable doubt that we're going to get to our destination. Everything we do is only beyond a reasonable doubt. I guess maybe one of the yardsticks that could be used in jest is, as sure as you are that your mother is your mother, you know, can't really be 100% sure. I always tell about the story of my young daughter who's, now she's married, but she, one day I find her going through my papers, and she's looking for her adoption papers. All of a sudden it occurred to her maybe she's adopted. She wasn't, but, you know, that's, how do you know your mother is your mother? I know. That's enough. That's the level, that's the standard of truth. Throughout the generations, that's what's used in the court of law, beyond any reasonable doubt. And emunah is something else. You see, emunah is something I choose to believe. When I choose to believe something, if I choose not to believe it, then I don't believe it. It's a choice. There's no empirical evidence. There's no testimony. It's a choice. Now, you'll say, then why do we find mitzvah lahamin? There's a Anochi says the mitzvah is emunah, even though the Rambam calls it yediyah in the Yarech HaZokah. So I'll tell you a very simple thing, and with this I think we'll conclude. Moshe Rabbeinu stood in front of Klal Yisrael at the end of his life. 40 years in the Midbar, leading Klal Yisrael throughout. He's making his final speeches, and he reviews with them the miracles of Yitzias Mitzrayim and what they witnessed themselves. I witnessed the Har Sinai, and that morning for breakfast they had mon again for the 40 years they've been eating mon in the Midbar and the Be'er and the Anani HaKovid and the Amud Eish and so forth and so on. And then he says to them, V'yodato hayoim, you should know this day. Knowledge, you know it. And return it to your heart. The Targum says, it's a suv lelibach. I ask you, how could you say, return it to your heart, knowledge which I know to be true? I stood at Har Sinai. My father stood at Har Sinai. I went through the Yamsuf. I had mon for breakfast. I live in an Ani HaKovid. I live in the Amud Eish at night. You're telling me, how can I forget? Hashem Elokim, I lived that day and night. Once there's a Rav in Brooklyn who once told me many years ago that he keeps his Rosh Hashiva's picture on his desk. And when he wanted to do something that the Rebbe wouldn't approve of so much, he puts the picture face down. We do that to the Rabbeinu Shel Olam. V'yodato hayoyim v'hashevois alavecha, return it, return it. Because our taivas, our desire to be free, the burdens, the pressures, whatever it may be, they try to convince us that it's not true. They try to help us lose focus. We get ADD. We can't focus. I forget. I don't know. Return it. Return it. Return it. It's yediyah. It's not emunah. But the emunah says, believe it. Return that knowledge to your heart. Because the Yetzer Hara, because the pressures, because the overwhelming responsibilities sometimes try to convince us to drop it, to confuse about it, to forget about it. The mitzvah is to return it. Torah Sinai and Yetzias Mitzrayim are historical facts, just as George Washington was the first president of the United States. But you know what the difference between George Washington being the first president of the United States and Torah Sinai is? Do you know why people will still question Torah Sinai, even though it's a historical fact with eyewitness testimony, and they won't question George Washington as the first president of the United States? And even 500 years from now and 1,000 years from now, they still won't question that? Because who could care less if George Washington was president of the United States? Who does it affect? How does that curb my lifestyle? Why does that tell me what to do? It has no shaykhis to me. But when it has a shaykhis to me, then all of a sudden historical fact goes into denial. Historical fact, testimony, evidence, eyewitness testimony. But I'll deny it. Much like the cancer research and the smoker. The smoker knows the research. He knows the fact. But the taiva, the desire, the habit, the craving for the nicotine pushes the fact aside. No, it's not going to happen to me. I belong to the club of the people who are going to live forever. It's not going to affect me. I'll change later. Something, this, that, the other thing. The mind does that. So we have to know. It's yediyah. Maimon Har Sinai is a historical fact. Yetzias Mitzrayim is a historical fact. There are millions of eyewitnesses, and we have to convey this to our children. But they have to understand that the burden of this historical fact sometimes leads people to want to question. You know, I used the word conclude already, but you'll forgive me just once more. I'll conclude in a moment. Just one more little thought. I remember on a short flight that I once took from Los Angeles to San Diego. It's about a 20-minute flight. I sat down on my aisle seat, and next to me across the aisle was a Midwestern elderly couple. They said, Shalom, and I answered, Shalom. Then they made this little speech. We support Israel. Israel belongs to Jewish people because God gave it to them. We know so because it says so in the Bible. And that was really the end of the speech, the end of the flight. And I'm getting off the flight, and I said, Rabbeinu Shel Olam. Here you have these two Gentile people, a billion like them. Must be over a billion such people, Bible-believing Christians. Every word it says in the Bible is true. We got Nebuch Yidden that are not so sure. Hayitochen? How could such a thing be? And I realized it was really very simple. And I'd like to conclude and explain this with a medrash, which I'll stop in the middle and just make a joke about. So you'll have to catch where the transformation between the medrash and the joke. Kodesh Baruch Hu comes to all the Umay Yisraelim and says, do you want to accept my Torah? So they ask, Maksiv Bey, what does it say? Lo Yisirtzach, not for me. Lo Yisignov, not for me. Not for me. They weren't interested. He comes to Klal Yisrael and he says, do you want to accept my Torah? Ad Kan. That's the end of the Midrash. Klal Yisrael says, how much does it cost? He says, it's for free. They say, we'll take two. That's why you got the Luchis. That's not true. It's a joke. But that's the idea. When it's free, I'll take two. No problem, no burden. The Goyim outsmarted us over here. The whole Bible is true, but you don't have to do it. Of course, if it's true, I don't have to do it. I have no problem with the truth. The truth is obvious. It reeks of truth. It reeks of truth. From beginning to end, the clarity of the truth is overwhelming. But not to one who feels that he has to pay a dear tire, a dear price for it. To such a person, he begins to wonder, maybe, I don't know, and that's really what this is all about. So, Bezras Hashem, I think that if we could really just use this evening maybe as a beginning, think about these issues, read about these issues, learn more about these issues, and then over a period of long period of time, not in a lecture, our children hate lectures, especially from their parents. They hate lectures. They hate lectures from anybody, I guess. But generally, in question, the Shabbos table, a few minutes here, a few minutes there, when you capture a window of opportunity, put in chizuk, evidence, testimony, feeling good, understanding, relevance, benefits, making me feel good about myself. That combination will, I think, bring about the fulfillment of the words of the Novi, will strengthen that emuna. It will be a clear yediya, and we'll talk a bizeicher to deiros of Yirei Mushleimim. If there are any questions or any, yes.
Can a child does something wrong, how is he not supposed to? Not supposed to.
Well. Well, first of all, it's, what? Yeah, the question is, a child does something wrong, you know, you're not supposed to criticize. What are you supposed to do? How do you handle it? Well, I think that, number one, there's a couple of principles which can be used. Number one, it's always better if you can have a discussion, shaloi b'shas ma'isa, rather than a confrontation b'shas ma'isa. You know, I tell teachers, and I think the same thing applies to parents, although it's harder for parents, but probably one of the first lessons of teaching is to learn what not to see. As a parent, too, sometimes we have to what not to see. And if we don't see it, we don't have to react, if it isn't a question of danger or something, it's much best not in a confrontational moment, not caught red hot with the goods, but to have a conversation and to discuss. And maybe there's a wink in the eye, and the kid probably understands that, you know, you're referring to something, but it has much more of an impact. It's not confrontational. It's not over a gotcha. You did something wrong, and now I'm attacking that. So that's one thing, I think, when that is possible, that is one way. What? Oh, so principal called kicked out of class. So first of all, that brings me to my second point, but I have a few other points on that particular example. The second point is, and this is something I heard many years ago from Rav Pam, Zachrinu Levrocha. He said there's two ways of giving teichocha. He says you can give teichocha by building up the mistake, the chet, or by building up the person. He said that's a drash, a chet, a chet, a misecho, like sisol of chet. Build the person, not the chet. He says like this. If you build the chet, say, how could you do such a terrible thing? The kid walks away and he'll say, it's not so terrible. You know, 2 minutes later, he'll rationalize it. However, if you say, you're such a chosh of a person, how could you, you know, it's for you. that he's not going to walk away and forget about. So if we do have to speak, when we say, like, you know, you're so good, you're so choshev, you're such a special person. You have such kishreinus, you have such capability. You do so good, you're such a good, you understand so much. Spasnish, you should, something like that. You really have to be careful about it. If it's preceded by a building up of the person, and the only reason that this is considered something wrong is because I'm really like Avraham Avinu, and on his level, this is a little bit inappropriate, it's much more palatable. It's much easier to get in. That's number one. Number two, when a kid gets thrown out and so forth, you really have to listen to the kid's side too. And please forgive me, but sometimes you have to sympathize with the child's position too. Because, I know these things go up on websites and where have you, but not every time that a child is asked to leave is it really justified. And you must be open-minded enough to listen, to see if it is and if it wasn't. In fact, the truth of the matter is that throwing a child out is really rarely justified unless it's at the point where it's absolutely disturbing the others from learning. Because just to, you know, throw it out so you get out of here, you don't bother me, that's really not so posh. So then you have to listen, and you have to understand, and you have to sympathize, and you have to say, I understand where you're coming from, and I realize that, and maybe the teacher didn't see that. However, you still have to be, the more positive you could be about what happened, the more sympathetic you could be to what happened, the more the ultimate part, the end part of the criticism or of the teaching or the guidance that you have to give will be palatable. It'll be something that they can take because you've made me feel so good about myself that I can handle it. Now I can handle that. You're right. Fataka's such a great person like me. You know, I hate to admit it publicly, but I was a little kid, and what's the difference? I'm getting old already. I remember the last day that I didn't wear tzitzis. I was a little kid. The Rebbe came over to me and said, you're such a good student. Spasnish, you shouldn't wear your tzitzis. That was the last day. Never, and I was mamish like, such a good student. That's different. That's a reason. You see, shaygetz! You call me a shaygetz, I'm going to be a shaygetz. Oh, but such a good student. So I think that has to be, you know, some of what we have to do. Also, I think that we should keep in mind that the concept of punishment is really a concept of teaching. The shirish of discipline, as I mentioned, is really disciple. It's really teaching. The idea of, I mean, there's other reasons for it too, of not giving an einish unless there's an azhora. The warning is because the einish is all part of, we're warning you that this is going to happen if you do it because we really want to teach you how serious an infraction this is. If we keep that in mind, that we're really, it's not about punishing. Sometimes the only way to teach is to deprive or to punish, that may be. But the concept involved is I want you to learn the lesson. That's why a lot of the punishments that are given are really off the wall. I mean, just don't make any sense. Because if the punishment has nothing to do with what was done, then the punishment isn't teaching me anything. You have to, if somebody did something wrong, to assign a writing, random writing, where they write each word down the column 100 times, they get their sister or brother to write the other word, and, you know, that doesn't do very much. But if it's a writing, a paper, and doing some research about what kas or chutzpah or destroying somebody else's property or disturbing a classroom, this has a constructive. That's like the best I could do on that issue. Yes, I had a hand up there for a long time.
The Rebbe was talking about the Amunah. There are two Inyanim in the Amunah. There's Yediyah and there's Regesh. What I understand from what the Rebbe was saying is that all this really has to be a basis in your sight in the Hanhagas HaBayis. Because without that, when the kids grow up, they really don't have it in them. But today's time, okay, in all times, but we're talking about today's time, there are so many problems outside and so many influences. knows it be Yediyah, but these things are happening to them or within the family situation, and the regish is there, and they're having a difficult time dealing with it.
I'm not sure that I understand the question. If I understand it correctly, I think that you're saying that even though they had the basics and they know the basics, they've been brought up with the basics, but the when difficulties come and there are temptations in life that accost them, how do we, you know, deal with those issues? That's very complicated, very difficult, and very relevant in today's world. Just a couple of thoughts which, you know, maybe might be helpful. Number one, I think the yisod of temptation, or the major concept of the vulnerability that we have to temptation, is the void that exists inside. If we feel fulfilled, we are much less prone to any outward temptation. Just like, if you'll permit me, a very base moshul, the person who has had a 7-course dinner and is completely full is less tempted by the 4th dessert that they see out. Well, maybe it's not true, but I don't know. But should be less tempted by the dessert that they see out there than one who hasn't had his fill. So when there's a void, that's when temptation is most successful in entering. So what we really have to do is to fill that void. You'll find that most people who get involved in the taivus olam hazeh and the temptations that are there usually think very little of themselves. They don't feel good about themselves. In fact, what we sometimes have to tell them is the taiva that you're involved with is just making you feel worse about yourself. I'll tell you why. Because if the definition of happiness is feeling valid, is feeling good about yourself, when I need a drink or a drug or a thrill to make myself feel temporarily good, that makes me feel bad about myself. I am such a nothing. I am such a ephes. I am such a messed up person that the only way I can feel temporarily good is to take something that's not me and bring it from the outside. I can only be chemically happy. I can't be emotionally happy. So people have to hear that. And they have to be educated to this. And even if they're at the stages already where they fall into these things, part of the process of weaning them off these temptations has to do with this. That's number one. Number two, I think that we have to, in a very non-threatening way, and usually not a parent, and usually not a teacher, sometimes a psychologist or a counselor, more often a mentor or a friend, just to let them know about the dangers, the danger in which they are putting themselves in this behavior. How it's going to, I must tell you that I deal very often with teenage boys that are getting involved with relationships in their teenage years that are just going to be trouble for them. And it's very difficult to wean them off of these relationships. But one of the things that does help sometimes, if you can dangle in front of them, if they're 16, 17, not 12, 13, which they're also starting those things today, but you say, listen, another couple of years you get married. What you do now can hurt your married life. What you do now can give you the wrong habits, the wrong ideas, the wrong values, the wrong sense of respect, the false concept of what these things are all about. You might fall in and end up with the wrong person that you'll regret for the rest of your life. This relationship might tend to compete with a real relationship later that you could have, which could last. I say today, the kids of this generation might be happily married for 80 years. They might be able to celebrate the 80th anniversary. And you're sacrificing all of that. So they begin to see, hey, not that they're going to stop overnight with such a speech. Believe me, it never happened once yet. But little by little, you wean them away from it. That's also something that may help. I think there's there's also something else that helps. And this is a little bit harder to hear. Chazal say that if a person's Yetzirah gangs up on him, you know, Yitzchok is Gabriel Alecho, Moshcheu lebeis Hamedrash, drag him into the Beis Medrash. Now, I don't think it just literally means walk into the Beis Medrash, the Yetzer Hara will disappear. But Limud HaTorah, excitement in learning, has a power to create a certain satisfaction that can compete and eventually show up the false pleasures of this world. Rashi says that in Shir HaShirah, where it says, Nazkiro Deidecho Miyayin, that when they delight in Torah, all of a sudden it's sort of they remember, Maimon Har Sinai, closest with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. These are the things that life is really about. And I must tell you from experience that through relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu and through excitement with learning, which is also a connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we have been able to wean young men away from all kinds of terrible relationships, which were just the product of desire and taiva and nothing else, and just by supplanting it with a more spiritually fulfilling relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's a little bit more sophisticated, a little bit more difficult, but I think these are some of the ideas that might be helpful. Also, if you're dealing with addiction, which sometimes the people that get involved with the pleasures, you see, the general chokhmah is that there are addictive personalities and non-addictive personalities. They say maybe even half the population might have an addictive personality. What that usually means is once they've gotten into some addictive type of behavior, they really, you know, really get into it and they get caught up in it. Sometimes for those things, they need professional help as well. So that's also an option. If it's in an addictive mode, professional help would be called for. Yes? A little louder. Yeah. Okay. So that's a very, very good question. How do you get kids to listen? Well, by invoking Kibbud Av Ve'Em is probably the best way to get them not to listen. So, you know, just have to get off our high horses, you know, and forget about that. In this generation, we are not living in the generation of Kibbud Hoirim. We're not living in the generation of Kibbud anything. You know, so I think that's not the way to do it. Usually the way to get people to listen is to divert their focus into something that interests them. If you start with, I'll never forget one of my fondest moments as a parent was when I couldn't get my kid to learn with me, Gemara for some, whatever it was, I don't know what it was for. Maybe it was time to learn. I couldn't get him. I was not shy of. And I started for about 20 minutes talking about baseball, about which I knew nothing about, and just like asking questions. And you know, after that 20 minutes, we had the best 45-minute learning session, uninterrupted, excited, involved session that we ever had. Because, like, I drew him into it on his terms, something that interested him. That's very important. If our children feel that the listening is involved in a lecture or a speech or disciplinary talk or controlling talk or deprecating talk, they're not going to listen. When the tone of the conversation is casual, is almost like negotiation, if it has to be serious, or just casual conversation, it's much more effective. By the way, negotiation with children is a very effective technique because it makes them feel that you respect them. Now, I don't mean negotiation, they have equal rights, you know, and all of that, but that you respect them and you respect their space, you respect their needs, but we have to work out something which satisfies our concerns as much as possible, but allows for their concerns as well. And that oftentimes can be very, very helpful and a more positive type of a thing. I think that you'll find that, I don't know if it's practical or you want to do it, but going out for, Many a dispute was resolved over a cup of coffee. That's only a cup of coffee, let alone if you took them out to a dinner, you know, to a pizza, to a dinner or something. When you go out, it's a social atmosphere. It's, you know, the best way to a man's heart, you know. And so that's also something which can be helpful. Sometimes you let them do something that they want you to take them driving, but you really rather somebody else takes them driving the way they drive. But no, you take them out and you let them, you know, and in the middle of the driving, we're talking, have a little conversation, a word here, a word there, gentle, dispassionate, not getting excited, explaining, listen to their point of view, recognizing and acknowledging the right that exists in their point of view, despite holding your own that, hey, this is unfortunately the way it is. Another piece of advice in this whole thing is, anytime you can come in the name of health or safety rather than religion, you're much better off. Religion is the most painful restriction that our kids know. Anything that has to do with halacha, that has to do with hashkofa, that has to do with minig, that has to do with tznius, that has to do any of these things, these are sandpaper to many of our kids. Whereas it's a matter of, you know, this is, I'm worried about your security, I'm worried staying out late, not because I'm afraid of what you're going to do, I'm afraid of what could happen, you know. And even though they don't agree, I as a parent have a right to say, listen, I can't. I toss and turn, I can't go to sleep unless you're in the house and you have to be in by a certain time, I can't help it. So when it's not in the name of religious concerns, I think it's also much more powerful and there's much less resistance on that point. Yes?
When we tell a child, first you belong to Muslim or Russia, if you go to Yahoo, that's good, because who cares if there is a Muslim? It's Hashem. And he says, Tati or Rebbe, is there a logical necessity that there is this Chacham Kol Yachol and Chacham Chesed who created this universe from absolute nothing and sustains it? Does the universe unequivocally testify to this? I would say that the answer to that child has to be absolutely yes. There is an absolute logical necessity. The universe does unequivocally testify that there's a couple of right? And every Rebbe has to tell this, and if a child has, or a father has to tell this, and then if a child has questions on that, so then we have to direct them to those who think more.
Yeah, I'm afraid that you're certainly right, but I think that when you're talking about the logical necessity, you're dealing maybe in a college classroom. You know, you're not dealing with the little kids or even with the younger kids as they get older. It's a concept which is a bit abstract. I think I do agree with you very much that showing them the Niflois Habiri and being nispoil with the Niflois Habiri, both the hashgocha protis on the human level and the beauty and the complexity of creation, I think that is a very positive influence. But I'm afraid if it gets into the philosophical part, today, fortunately or unfortunately, whatever the case may be, we don't live in a generation of philosophers anymore. We're no longer pondering the cosmos to figure out what life is all about. So I think it's a little bit much for some of our children. I don't want to take too. Is there anyone? No, because I don't want to belabor the point, because I don't think it's going to.
I just want to say that my child, right, his college professor was constantly making comments in class, right? My son said to him, my father had a bone to pick with you, and we sat down and did 14, 90-minute tapes at the bed.
Okay. Okay, good. But I'm saying this is not in the context of these younger kids. I don't think that is the. I don't think they can relate to such sophisticated. You know, that's for the older generation.
But
okay. If you want to say it, I may not know what you mean, but it ain't gonna hurt. Okay. Anything else? Yes.
Won't that get the child more involved?
Okay. So enthusiasm is a great thing for things that aren't too close to home. When you're dealing with something that's a painful or burdensome topic, there are things called defense mechanisms. Defense mechanisms mean that I know if I listen, buy into, and accept what you're telling me, it's going to curtail my freedom, it's going to make my life too burdensome, it's going to make it difficult, it's going to be too expensive, too much pressure, too whatever it is. And by the way, it's not the topic of this conversation. Our kids are under enormous religious pressure. They are overwhelmed with the religious pressure. They don't know what we have learned, that you can compromise a little bit, you know, this is the right way, but they're very straight. And that pressure is overwhelming, overwhelming. And Mimele, you got to be very careful. The defenses go up. The best way to bypass defenses is by downplaying, cool, matter of fact. When you start, you know, I mean, there's a very interesting debate in public speaking about the charismatic speaker as opposed to the lemachol. And in many ways, when it comes to brainwashing, the lemachol could do more than the charismatic speaker. Because the charismatic speaker is a threat. Because, oh, you're doing a number on me. Oh, you're trying to brainwash me. Ah, you're trying to convince me. The lemachol gets up there, you know, and it's non-threatening. There's no defense mechanism against it. So in a sense, sometimes we have to be careful not to be, the more excited we get, the more we yell and scream, the more they become defensive and they become overwhelmed. So sometimes a understatement is more effective. It's true that it's important to have passion too, but I would have more passion about the things that don't seem directly relevant to them. In other words, if you wanted passionate hispailus of the godless of the bria, or a passionate hispailus of the hashkocha protis, that's good. So then you see about they see that. But if you get passionate about Maimon Har Sinai and you're trying to convince with passion, sometimes the extra passion in the process of conviction raises these defenses and it makes it harder. That's yes. I mean, well, so I don't know. You're talking about the difficulties of life. So, you know, a little bit we discussed that a person, we must develop, and the time to develop it is before tragedy strikes. It's much easier to have the basis before the problems and then to follow up and expound and expand upon it when the problem starts. But the basis of understanding the benefits of suffering in this world, the cheshbonos that exist in this world, and how to put those things in perspective. That's something that's very important. If that hasn't happened, then they don't know that there are nisyonos in life. They don't know the benefit the nisyonos elevate us and make us into better people. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a cheshbon for everything, and he gives schar and so forth. Then, of course, it has to be explained. But it's harder when they're in that matzav. One of the things that do help is revisiting the basics, because what I find is people in that matzav are not only bitter or frustrated or overwhelmed, but they also begin to be shaky in the hashkofa and in the emuna, what we call it, you know, the ideas, that until then were not problems for them. When things are going well, Hashem created the world, he gave a Torah at Har Sinai, everything is wonderful. But when it starts to hurt, then we start to subconsciously maybe subtly reevaluate these things. So they need to be reinforced. So I think a review, a refresher course in the basics will, you know, v'hashivoyse levovecho, I think that can also help. I think sometimes just listening to people's problems can be therapeutic, and just like somebody cares, somebody hears what I have to say, somebody feels that pain, it eases the pain a little bit, and therefore it doesn't have such devastating effects. And sometimes people in a very difficult situation need outside professional help, which is also something that shouldn't be discounted completely. But the one thing that I think is more important than anything else, in difficult situations like that, you should not think you're going to do anything in one day. It's a process. It's not a meeting. It's not a discussion. It's a process. It's gradual. A young man who there was a tragic loss in a family just a couple of days ago, and one of the family members called me this evening, and besides the fact that I was late, coming here, but I had to tell him, I said, the wound is too fresh to even discuss it now. Chazal say the first 3 days of mourning are for crying, not for nichum, not for tanchumin. Let it out. Sometimes people have to cry it out and just know that people sympathize with them, and then later on you could start gradually, building the pieces. Oftentimes, if it's a family member or a close friend, you need somebody who's a little bit more distant from the situation, who has some experience with these things, who can talk to them because, they listen differently from someone that they're not immune to. So that may be another eitzah that could be helpful in that area. Gute Nacht, Kol Tuv.
Thank you for listening to this presentation brought to you by Priority One. Please visit us online at www.priority-one.org. That's priority-1.org, where you can download free audio and publications on parenting, teaching, and teens at risk. For more information or to make a donation, please visit us online or call 800-33-4EVER.